listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
We're gathered here tonight just days after the fourth anniversary of perhaps one of the most miraculous rescues of all time that took place at the San Jose mine in northern Chile, where 33 miners were pulled from the bowels of the earth to the surface after 69 grueling days of being trapped underground. Author Hector Tobar takes us deep down dark into the mine, over 2,000 feet below, and into the refuge where the 33 call home for 2 months, the first 17 days of which the world doesn't even yet know they are alive. Deep Down Dark reveals for the first time this part of their captivity, a period sworn to secrecy until now. Tobar's nuanced narrative of the 33 and the men and women who guided their rescue rings with the poetic subtleties intrinsic to daily life in Latin America. And it is told with the integrity of a seasoned journalist whose non-native lens casts a perceptive look at a journey that seems incredulous to any non-believer. His own Latin American roots dig deep into the story and into the lives of the miners with a sensitivity and soulfulness unique to the author. Held captive from the first few pages on, it would be no far stretch to call this piece of writing a masterpiece. And in the spirit of the Library Foundation's month-long LA Odyssey project occurring during the month of October all throughout the city, I couldn't help but quote the beautiful analogy critic Scott Wallace wrote in a recent LA Times review of Tobar's book. If the miners bear some resemblance to a motley band of sailors blown terribly off course in an ancient Homeric legend, their women battling for their return evoke the stoic determination of 36 Penelopes. And therein may lie the secret to this book's page-turning resonance. It's a story as old as the ages, and it really happened in our lifetime, privileging us for a fleeting moment with a glimpse at the miracle of our common humanity, the mystery of our species' true potential for goodness, self-sacrifice, and courage in the face of imminent death. Deep Down Dark is Hector Tobar's fourth book. The others include The Barbarian Nurseries, Translation Nation, and The Tattooed Soldier. Tobar is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and is a native of Los Angeles. Moderating the conversation tonight is Jesse Katz, author of The Opposite Field. As a staff writer at the LA Times, Katz shared in 2 Pulitzer Prizes. And as senior editor at Los Angeles Magazine, he received the Penn Center USA's Award for Literary Journalism. His most recent story, Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers, will be produced as a film by Rat Pack Entertainment. Please join me in welcoming Hector Tobar and Jesse Katz to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Wow, here we are again, Hector.
We are just again.
3 years ago, 3 short years, that I got to sit here with you upon the publication of The Barbarian Nurseries. And here you have another book. And I know that it took enormous dedication and determination and discipline to make that happen. And the great thing is the achievement of this book for me, if I can just sort of interject my opinion, is you've taken something really familiar, something a lot of us saw play out on TV news, and, you know, in other hands, it could have been something, you know, purple or saccharine, some melodrama, and you've elevated it into literature. And you turn these events into a really a meditation on what it means to be alive and human, and it's really a lovely book. Some of us probably know this story very well. There may be a few newcomers to it. So I'd like to just start from sort of setting the scene. If you could paint a picture of where in the world we are. We're out somewhere in the Chilean desert, many thousands of miles from here in an alien landscape.
Right. The San Jose mine was located, the remains of it are still located, in the Atacama Desert, which is in northern Chile, about an hour drive north of the city of Copiapó, which is a city of about 170,000 people that has always been a mining city almost throughout its entire history. And so this particular mine was a gold and copper mine following a vein of ore in the Andes that was created during the time of the dinosaurs when broth seeped up from these two tectonic plates and created this deposit of gold and copper. And the Atacama is famous as not only the driest desert on Earth, but probably also the oldest. And it's said that there are weather stations at the Atacama that have not received a single drop of rain in their entire existence of more than 100 years of Chile's National Weather Service. So it's a very dry place. Every once in Copiapó, every 10 or 12 or 13 years or so, there's a big serious rain, and then the entire city, well, the heart of the city can flood. So it's a place of extremes, so dry that NASA even has a center there to study how to survive in alien landscapes.
Yeah. Tell me about the architecture of this mine. One of the, I think, the challenges of this book and one of the remarkable achievements is trying to create a picture of what this subterranean space looks like. And the phrase you use is an iceberg city. Tell us what that means.
Yeah, actually, I did spend a lot of time trying to familiarize myself, talking to the miners, with the lingo of mining, with their own histories, their own family histories with the mine. So the mine was founded in 1889, and for the first 60 or 70 years or so of its history, they simply drilled a hole down following the vein. But very quickly that became too expensive. And so they drilled they blasted this highway into the mountain. So the mountain is mostly made of diorite, which is like granite, and it's a very, very hard stone. So they blast this highway, which is big enough to fit a truck, you know, a good-sized truck, and it spirals down through the mine. At first, it's a series of switchbacks, and then it becomes a spiral. And from this central passageway, which is called La Rampa, the ramp, they built horizontal passageways to where the ore was to extract the ore. But in extracting ore, you know, imagine several hundred tons of ore every day for 119 years, eventually you leave this vast interior space, which they call el rajo. That means rip or tear. My translation for it was the pit, because that's what it is. It's like this interior canyon, this abyss that exists within this block of stone.
Remind us how deep this is.
It is 2,100, more than 2,100 feet deep. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for the Hajj Burqa in the United Arab Emirates, it would be deeper than the tallest building on Earth is tall. So I had to always qualify it. Nearly as deep as the tallest building on Earth is tall.
Well, 2,000 feet, just as a point of comparison, the building across the street, the tallest building in L.A., the formerly known as the Library Tower, now the U.S. Bank Tower, is 1,000 feet. So we're talking about two of those buildings stacked on each other looking down.
Exactly, yes.
Makes me queasy.
Well, and also it's at a 10% grade, so the drive down was about 5 miles long, 4 or 5 miles long. It would take, going down, of course, it was faster. Well, actually, going down was faster, and then coming up with ore, it was much slower. So that drive itself was a 30, 40-minute drive.
Wow. What does it mean to be a Chilean miner? You talk about these guys as, they're the niños, or sometimes they're the viejos, or the knuckleheads.
Or the huevones.
The huevones, so a word that comes up quite a bit in this book. Maybe you can translate that for us. But what does it mean? How are they wrapped up in the national identity of Chile?
Yes, I think for me, Chile is a country which mining is a really strong part of its national identity. also poetry. You know, it's a country with two Nobel laureates who are poets. And I think there is both a poetic sensibility and a real pride in what miners do. You know, the stories of miners are, children read stories of miners. There's a famous book called Subterra by Baldomero Lillo that many Chilean school children grew up reading. Of course, there's a National Day of the Miner. And later, when the men were trapped during the Day of the Miner, and they actually celebrated the Day of Miner when they were trapped and sang the national anthem. So I think that there is this sense of mining as this risky, noble endeavor that has helped build Chile as a country.
There's like a ruggedness. I mean, I almost think of it like saying you're an Alaskan fisherman or something.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what the right comparison is, but you have to be kind of hard-headed in a way to do this as well.
Right. It's very, it's hyper-masculine, although, and you know, there's all this mythology, and one of the myths is that a woman in a mine is bad luck. Although I found out later from some of these guys that they had, one of them had a sister who was a miner, who had her own little mine that she operated, that she worked. So there is a lot of, it's a very, very male culture, but at the same time, it's said that the mine is a woman, you know, the mountain is a woman, and in a certain sense, you're violating her every time you go into the mountain. So there's all of this amazing mythology about it.
And Satan is down there too, right?
Right. It's said that Satan lives in all gold mines, yes. And then Satan later makes an appearance in my book. I didn't make it up. It's yeah.
And what's it like down there? I mean, even under the best of conditions, it's
right.
Ridiculously hot, humid,
right.
Difficult place to work.
Well, I had the good fortune to enter another mine. And first of all, I did go to the actual San Jose mine several times, and I walked, in the first 10 or 20 meters or so. And that particular mine is an absolutely horrific place. It looks improvised. They've blasted this hole into the mountain, and it looks like this malformed orifice. And then going into a mine deeper, you experience this total darkness. And you feel these, you know, if you close your eye, you know, when I went in, they had us turn off our lamps. And after a while, you could feel the breeze shifting. And so there are shifts and breezes there. It's like a weather inside the mine. And I also had a chance to see one of these pits, which is, you know, you shine your light and there's nothing. It's black. The light just is swallowed by the darkness. And then in this particular mine, and I think in this region of Chile, the deeper you go, the hotter it gets. And that has to do with the geothermal heat of the earth. You know, you're just closer to it. There's less ventilation. And this particular mine was so poor in terms of its standards that the ventilation was even poorer. Sometimes it would get up to, 40 degrees Celsius, you know, almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The humidity would be 90%. Many of the men, when they went in to work on a 9 o'clock shift in the morning, they would not eat because they knew that if they ate, they would throw up by 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning from the heat and the humidity. So it was horrible.
So this is even under, regular conditions,
a normal
right?
working day in the San Jose mine, right.
And but at this particular time, things were degrading quickly, right? Some combination of, greed, negligence, mismanagement, just the economics of mining, whatever safety mechanisms there might have been, and really a century of extracting ore had left this place kind of like a house of cards.
Exactly. And there were these warnings, this constant sort of noise. Many of these men had worked in several other mines. And mines are always alive, apparently. They're making noise. There's movement of rock in them. So to be working and suddenly to hear this distant thunder of a rock fall within the structure of the mine is not terribly unusual. Right. However, in this particular mine, it was building in frequency. And several of the men told their wives, and their wives confirmed to me, or their girlfriends confirmed to me, they were saying things like, la mina está llorando mucho, the mine is weeping a lot. So this thunder that you would hear, or this wail, and I actually have one recording where I heard one of these wails, that comes from the distant rockfall would come through, and they were coming more frequently. And so that particular day, in the hours before, it's like, the previous shift, hey, you guys, you should know the mine is crying a lot. Yeah, it always is. But, and so it begins making more of this noise, which are these rock falls, these internal rock falls.
So put us there on that day. It's August 5th.
Right, 2010.
What actually happens to this mine?
Well, later the Chilean government reconstructed what happened, but essentially this huge diorite, this diorite stone, which everyone would say in the mining industry was good stone because it sort of held together really well, it was really hard. No one expected that to fail, and the ramp was in it. And so if that could never fail, then there was always a way out because you could always drive up out the ramp. Well, an entire huge block of this mountain, the weight of the Empire State Building, or more than the weight of the Empire State Building, about maybe 40 stories high, but it's solid rock, so it's heavier. It just came crashing down through the structure of the ramp, knocked out all the ramp, knocked out many other things. And it sent this first this blast wave down through the mine, through the levels of the mine. And in the book, I follow this blast wave and the explosions and the noise as it goes down through the mine, because there were men working at many different levels. There was one person who was, it was past lunchtime. You know, they had, once again, they were late for lunch, because in this mine, everything was sort of always off. So the man driving he's driving the personnel truck. He's going back down into the mine to pick up the guys for lunch. It's 1:30, and this whole mine collapses just about 100 meters or so behind his truck. So he's the first one to feel it. In that moment, just before, I guess it must have been the pressure of this collapse, he saw a white streak go past the window of his truck. And the guy with him, Jorge Garaguillo, said, "Did you see that? That was a butterfly." And the guy says, "No, that's not a butterfly. It was a white rock." And they start arguing. "No, was it? Was it? Was it?" And then before the argument can be settled, the entire mountain collapses behind them. And so the pressure wave goes down. And at the very lowest levels of the mine, they didn't hear any explosion. They just felt this pressure. One guy described it as like being inside of the cylinder, a plunger, when they plunged it closed and open. And I could just feel my ears pressuring and going in and out. And very soon, this just waves of rock, waves of dust. It was like being inside of the earth in an earthquake. And so, I don't know if you've ever seen of those videos where an earthquake, you can see the ground undulating. Well, they saw the floor, the stone floor of the ramp undulating and the walls undulating. And for many men, this was the most horrific thing they'd ever lived through. And the trauma of it is still with them to this day.
Right. There were 33 people down there. They all survived this collapse, which is extraordinary unto itself. But then once they realize they're trapped, they have to deal with the reality. They don't know, even really know quite what they're waiting for, right? You know, they need somebody to start looking for them.
Right.
But, you know, there's the possibility that the people out in the surface world might just assume they're all dead down there. They have no ability in the early days to communicate at all. So they're, you know, in their minds, you know, this starts to sink in, and they're really screwed. I mean, they say "estamos cagados," right?
Right. Exactly. Yes.
Describe that realization, that sort of sinking feeling of.
Right. I think for many of them, the moment in which they realized how serious the situation was that they waited for all this dust and rock to settle, and they start driving back up the ramp because it's the only way out. And they suddenly come upon this obstacle that's blocking the ramp. And it's a brand new gray wall. And it's the stone of the mountain, but it's freshly cut. And one of the miners told me that was the scariest thing about it. You know, everything in that mine was so dirty, but this wall was like brand new. And one guy described it as like the stone covering Jesus's tomb, you know. Another person said it was like a guillotine of stone. And so that was so out of their experience. I mean, many of these men had worked in mines since their teenage years, or if not earlier, and no one had ever seen anything like that. So they knew they were in a very, there was serious position. And so they just have to, and so finally, they know they have to wait for somebody to come and get them, essentially.
Some of them had actually been in cave-ins before. I mean,
right,
it wasn't unusual
exactly.
for there to be a cave-in, but it could always be rectified by moving some boulders and.
Right, exactly. But nothing, this was totally outside of their experience.
All
yes.
Right. So let's leave them there for just a moment, because so much of what is special about this book is your ability then to reconstruct what happens to them underground. And that's also what's new about this book.
Right.
That's not something that we've been treated to before. How do you do a story like this? This is beautifully written. but it's also and rigorously reported. You had to reconstruct minutes and hours and days and weeks underground. You live here in Los Angeles.
Right.
For most of that time, you had a job at the LA Times. How do you?
Did, yes.
How do you? How do you find out what happened underground?
Well, I first of all, I did 5 trips to Chile, and in the initial trips, my first questions were not what happened, but how did you get into mining? You know, and I teach writing, and so I think one of the things when you teach fiction writing or literary nonfiction, you have to teach students to slow down, because it's in the details where the story is, and also it's in lingering in a moment or lingering in a character is where the humanity is, and the humanity is the story. People want to read about other people, so I did spend a lot of time getting to know them. And also, that communicated to them that I cared about all of their story, not just about whether they ate each other or how they survived. And I think that really set the tone.
Like, how many times would you interview a single person?
Well, some of them, I only interviewed them once in a group. You know, there's a few of them who were really hard to get, who I only interviewed once. In fact, one of the best interviews I did was just the single interview I did with him, although I did later call Victor Somoza back on the phone from the United States. I did some follow-up calls. But for some of them, I spoke once. Some of them I spoke 10, 15 hours with Mario Sepulveda, who ends up being the personality at the center of this human drama underground. I must have spoken to him 10, 15 hours in a series of interviews over many trips to Chile. He's going to be played by Antonio Banderas in the movie. it was just, you know, it's writing with questions and asking a lot of details. I had a lot to learn. I had to learn a lot of Chilean and mining idioms. You know, in Chile, a job, you know, Mexico, for example, we say la chamba is your job, you know, and it's a slang word for job. And in Chile, it's pega, you know. And then, of course, there's huevón, you know, which is both an insult and a term of endearment, you know. And so I had a lot to learn about Chile and also about each one of them. And I think the book ends up being organized around the best and the most important story each one of them wanted to tell me. Yeah.
There were also some primary sources, right? There was a little bit of video down there.
Yes.
And one of the miners amazingly kept a journal, right?
Yes, the journal was absolutely invaluable. I know that there are a few historians in the audience, and as you know, any written record is extremely important. Victor Segovia is a man with a fourth grade education, right, who actually never left, has never, up before the accident, never traveled more than 100 miles away from Copiapó. You know, that was his life. And he started, the second night, he started a letter, essentially was a letter to his daughters telling them what had happened. And then later that became a journal. His journal was extremely important because he put a date on everything. He also had kind of a darker outlook. So I had to sort of balance what he had said in his journal with other things that I'd heard, but definitely it was absolutely invaluable. Then I had all this photographic evidence. And there's a video that was shot right after they were found. And the Chilean government lowered a camera and shot this video of this man. It was maybe 2 or 3 days after they were found. And for me, you see it one way when you see it for the first time, but after you get to know these guys for a couple of years, I could see in that video how degraded they were and how beaten up they look. I mean, the look of trauma was on their face. It was difficult for many of them to talk. Many of them looked humiliated. And they weren't humiliated because of the way they looked and because they were on a camera, but you could tell that they were in a state of numbness. And I really relied on a lot of that physical evidence, you know, those photographs. There's a description of this pastor, this man who becomes a miner, becomes a pastor. He cuts his pants down to shorts. I saw that in a video, and I thought, oh, my God, he looks like some desert seer, you know, like some desert preacher. And so I describe him that way in the book.
Well, and that leads to sort of the next challenge, is you have this sprawling cast of characters. You have 33 dudes underground.
Right.
You have all their families and family complications above ground. You have politicians and bureaucrats. You have drillers and technologists and all this.
Right.
How do you, in your mind, how did you organize this? How did you know kind of the hierarchy of who to focus on and how to make sure each one of them came alive, or at least had a moment on stage?
Well, I started thinking about the general structure of the book, you know, and after sort of my first round of interviews, it became very obvious what the structure of the book would be, the general plot, if it were like a novel, and or if it was a screenplay, what the three acts were, you know. And it was very clear to me that those first 17 days they were trapped were this incredibly special, spiritual, strange, surreal time. And so, you know, you have a moment that, oh, that's the end of that section. The drill breaks through. And you just work toward that section. I was really fortunate because everyone, like I said, everybody had their sort of, human memory works differently. One guy really remembered the speeches people made, you know. Another guy really remembered, well, the physical details, what their feces looked like when they were starving. You know, Señor, it looked like llama pellets were coming out of our body, you know.
Did you ask that question? Did they volunteer that?
I must have asked that question, you know. Yes. But sometimes people, you know, people want to tell you, you know, many times it's just people volunteering this dramatic thing, you know. One man was on the ground for days and days, wouldn't get up. They're, you know, dying of hunger. Mario comes and, you know, threatens to eat him if he doesn't get up. Doesn't really mean it, but threatens him. And the guy stands up, and, you know, these are men who grew up, many of them, in rural settings, you know, on farms, and, you know. And so the guy tells me, you know, when Jimmy finally stood up, he looked like when a horse is being born, and he tries to straighten out his legs, you know. Oh, I thought, that's gold, you know. And so, yes, I'm fortunate to have had done 33 people, have 33 points of view, and just, you know, many, many hours of interviews, and I just mined the best stuff, mm-hmm. No pun intended.
So let's go back to that moment. So this place caves in on them. They're left to wait indefinitely.
Right.
The first thing that, you know, would occur to anybody in that circumstance, and you capture so vividly, is the sustenance. You know,
right.
What is there to eat and what is there to drink?
Right. They had a cabinet of emergency supplies. So according to Chilean law, they had to have enough food for 22 men for 2 days, which was already bad enough, except for the very first night, many of the men were hungry. They had not eaten breakfast, as I said, right? They had missed lunch because the lunch truck that was supposed to take them to the surface, you know, got stuck with them. So they had not had lunch. And so a group of men actually raided the emergency supplies. One other group of men tried to stop them, said, no, don't do this. Another guy said, I got this bolt cutter. I'm going to break that thing open. And finally, they found the key, and they opened it, and a group of men actually ate many of the cookies. Because what they had was 100 or so packages of these Oreo-style cookies with 4 cookies in each package. They were kids' cookies, and they were called cartoons. Mm-hmm. Later, I had people told me several different names for them, but then I found a video when they were opened it underneath, and I could see the package, cartoons. And I went to Copiapó, and I bought some. You know, vanilla wafers with cream in the middle or coconut filling. They had a few cans of tuna, a can of peas, and one can of peaches. A few liters of water. Not really very much to live on, no.
Tell me how that ended up getting doled out. I mean, the tuna, the peas.
Well, at first they decided they would have one cookie a day, and they would have a cup of water with a spoonful of tuna, and sometimes a little bit of this. They had some milk. They had also found some condensed milk, or not condensed, but, you know, a box of milk. Most of it had gone sour. They threw it away, except for one miner who picked up the boxes and drank some of the soured milk and later said, I'm going to live longer now, you guys, right? And so they would mix this up, and that would be their meal. They also had a picnic that they organized where they took a truck filter, and they made that into an air filter, made that into a pot, and they put a bunch of the tuna in it and some of this water. It's industrial water. It had motor oil in it. Someone said it smelled like a duck pond, you know? And that was their meal that they made. One. Someone said that if you heat up a meal, it has more calories. And so they did that. And also it got them out of the refuge. And this is also, it's a very fuzzy video, but what it does record is Mario's sort of trying to keep the spirits up of the men. It's actually a beautiful moment.
They were physically transformed during this time. They lost 30, 40 pounds during the course of this. But they were also, in a way, spiritually transformed. It was impossible for them, regardless of kind of what their religious background or orientation or depth of feeling was not to begin to question, why are we here? What are we waiting for? And they put enormous significance in the number 33
right.
As well. We talked about you reading a passage. Maybe this would be a good time to...
And I'll introduce this by saying what on the second night, I believe it was, Mario Sepulveda, who became this sort of leader, he starts pacing back and forth. And someone else told me the story. Mario didn't tell me this because that left this impression on a miner's memory. He said, I saw Mario pacing back and forth. And he said, he suddenly started yelling, I want to pray. You know, God damn it, I want to pray. And so he issues this call to prayer. And he turns to Jose Enriquez, who's a miner, who's an evangelical, and who I say, is one of those people in the mine who's kind of always sort of talking about religion, and people are always kind of irritated by him, But suddenly, here they are facing death, and suddenly they have a man of God. And so they ask him to lead the prayer, so he leads the first prayer. And in his first prayer, he says, No somos los mejores hombres. Lord, we aren't the best men, but have pity on us. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I recount how many of these men had committed many sins in their lives, the kind of sins that are common to the lives of men and often working men, adultery, not seeing their children, being very angry, everything that, we've all done things in our life. And so so many of the men remember those things. And so the prayer becomes this daily ritual. And not only that, at the prayer session, they also apologize to each other for things that they've done. And so they begin getting skinnier. And so I'll read this passage in which Jose Enriquez gives a sermon. They are not heroes, but ordinary men who are afraid, silencing their rumbling stomachs with large quantities of dirty water and waiting until noon when they all gather to eat. But first, just before the meal, the tall, balding Jose Enriquez begins the session with a prayer, and then a few words that serve as a kind of sermon. Sometimes he tells Bible parables from memory. There is, most appropriately, the story of Jonah, who was swallowed by a whale. Jonah was sent on a mission by God to speak in a certain village, but instead, Jonah got on a ship and went in the opposite direction. Jonah was a guy with a bad temper, Enriquez says, so God put the squeeze on him. The Lord sent a powerful storm to toss that ship about, and when Jonah's shipmates realized he was the source of God's wrath, they tossed him overboard where he was swallowed by a great whale. Disobedience is never good, Enriquez says. Jonah was in the belly of hell and in the depths, Enriquez says. Enriquez says, speaking a word that he remembers from a Bible passage, profundidad is the word in Spanish, and hearing it spoken by a man of God inside the depths of the mind leaves a powerful impression on the mind of diary writer Victor Segovia, who will scribble the word down a few hours later. I went down to the bottoms of the mountains, the Bible passage reads. The earth with her bars was about me forever. Jonah submits himself to the Lord. He says God has brought him up from a life of corruption and promises that he will sacrifice unto God with the voice of thanksgiving. The Lord then commands the whale to spit Jonah out. Here, in this horrific place, trapped inside stone walls, the message is more powerful than it will ever be when spoken in any church. It's as if they are living inside a Bible parable, Yoni Barrios thinks. They have survived 2 weeks without a true meal, with no certain prospects that they'll ever eat again, and everything that's happening to them seems to have some deeper message. Victor Segovia never went to church much, but now he's sort of going to church every day, because with each prayer session, the sense grows that the union of those 33 men is a holy event. Before this accident befell him, Victor writes in his diary, he thought of church as a place where sinners went to seek forgiveness. But Enriquez now speaks to him of a message of hope and love. The pastor is, by now, a man physically transformed too. He has shed his shirt against the relentless heat and humidity, cut off his pants to shorts, and walks around in ripped-up boots that look like sandals. Speaking of God with his bare chest and its patches of hair covered in sweat, and with his bald pate and its matted fringe of hair, Enriquez is beginning to look like a crazed mystic who lives in some desert cave, an effect heightened by the fact that when he speaks, he seems utterly convinced of what he's saying. Christ loves you in spirit, the pastor says. And Victor later records the pastor's words in his diary. Look for him, and you will see that he loves you, and you will find peace. For Victor, this is a revelation. I see now that people who are thankful go to church too, and that the people who go there have been touched by the grace of God, he writes. In another sermon, Enriquez tells the story of Jesus taking 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish and multiplying them to feed 5,000 people. He then leads them in a prayer that the Lord will find a way to take their small supply of food and make it last longer, because very soon they're going to run out. The pastor would pray that the food be multiplied, Mario Sepulveda later says. Afterward, I'd see one of los niños walk over to the cabinet and try to peek inside to see if there really might be more food in there. Instead, each opening of the cabinet reveals less food. The men begin to scavenge around to see what they might find to eat. Yoni Barrios, the man who failed to protect the food against the hungry men on the day of the collapse, sees one pick up a discarded can of tuna and take his finger to it, wiping the inside and licking his finger again and again. Yoni never thought he'd see a well-paid man like him reduced to such a state. Others begin to go through the trash cans, and when they find orange peels, they clean them well and eat them. The hunger was terrible, Yoni says. Victor has also eaten half-chewed fruit he found in the trash, and on Wednesday, August 11th, he writes about it in his diary, remembering how he used to see the poorest of the poor in Copiapó sifting through the garbage. We ignore it. People think that it will never happen to them, and now look at me eating peels, trash, anything that is edible. Carlos Mamani, the Bolivian immigrant, scans the ground to see if there are any bugs or worms crawling around. He would grab one if he saw it and eat it. But just as there are no butterflies in the mine, there are no beetles or caterpillars either. Didn't see a spider or even a termite. Nothing. So it's a passage from the book. Thanks.
I mean, that's a lovely passage, and it's also a reminder that, like, there's really no instruction manual for right. What to do when you're down in that situation. And there really wasn't a lot for these guys to do physically either, you know? It was mostly just kind of wait and stay sane.
Right.
It's also impossible to read this without imagining who you would be in that situation. Or it was for me, you know, would you be the Mario Sepulveda raging against the darkness? You know, we're going to get out of here alive. Or are you the guy curled up in a fetal position in the corner, just sort of bracing yourself for the inevitable? Were you thinking about that stuff as you were writing this?
Well, I think that, many of them were different people themselves. You know, Mario, I like to say, he wasn't just one Shakespearean character down there. He was 6 or 7 different Shakespearean characters. You know, Mario is Prince Hal. He's urging them all to fight on. And then he's Hamlet saying, I'm going to die down here. It's so unfair. And then he's Iago saying, you know, these guys are conspiring against me. And so, I think that, you know, people go through all sort of different, what really impressed me was that how everybody sort of contributed something. You know, there was the guy who was the busybody on an ordinary day, and he ends up telling them stories about, you know, Chilean labor law. You know, guys, it's going to be okay. We might die down here, but according to law 65, 24, 31, you know, all our family's going to be taken care of. And he would detail how much money they were going to get, and he was so detailed in it that they all believed him, you know?
Yeah. So this goes on for 17 days without contact with the outside world, with the above ground world. And finally on the 17th day, the drillers are able to bore a very narrow hole that breaks through to where these guys are at. Maybe we'll skip past the technology of that, but it does provides a link to the outside world where there's some communication going on back and forth. There's some nutrition being passed down there. And this is this moment of extraordinary national elation and pride. They're alive, right? Yet it doesn't necessarily bode well for the miners underground. It actually dramatically alters the dynamic among them. What happens?
Well, first of all, there is this moment of national celebration. I think that every Chilean knows where they were when they heard the news that the men were found alive. It's like, you know, like for us, the moon landing or something. People in Chile, this is a point of reference in the country. But yes, very quickly, they realize that not only is the minister of mining up there, not only is the president of their country on the other end of the line, but they also become the most famous miners on earth. You know, I mean, here are these guys working in this mine that nobody really wanted to work in, you know, where they were considered kamikazes for wanting to go work in this mine. And suddenly they become famous. And very soon the newspapers began to come down, the letters. A Chilean businessman, a very well-meaning man, Leonardo Farcas, who plays himself in the movie. I'm sorry, something else away. He gives them all a huge amount of money, more than $10,000 each, the equivalent of a year's salary, and urges Chileans to raise $1 million for each of them so they'll never have to work again. Several of the wives and girlfriends decide not to tell this to their husbands and boyfriends because they want them to worry about being alive. You know, their lives are still in danger, but a few just can't resist. And those that do get the letters tell the others, and very quickly the word spreads, we're rich. And so then it becomes a question of two things. One, who's getting the credit up there? There's a story. They end up reading a story in El Mercurio, or excuse me, La Tercera, which is one of the bigger newspapers in Chile, in which Mario and letters have been released, and Mario Sepulveda has told his son and wife, I am the absolute leader down here. And the rest of them say, hey, what is this? And they begin to split into these sort of deep camps. One miner gets very upset because his wife innocently sends him a picture because there are all these celebrities on the surface trying to raise the spirits of the families. And so she's with this group of of Chilean norteño music, like ranchera music, Chilean cowboy music, and there are these guys in these matching sort of black hats and, you know, and shirts, and they all have their arms around her and stuff. And he says, what did you send me this for? I don't want to see you with any huevones, much less one touching you, you know? And she tells me, you know, he was always jealous, but he was even more jealous when he was trapped down there, you know? So, yeah, so it became very, very surreal. Luis Ursúa, he's asked to speak to everybody. One day it's Palestine has an ambassador in Chile. So he's talking to the Palestinian ambassador. And then a couple of days later, it's the Israeli ambassador. And so it was a very strange thing for them.
Right. Like this total isolation and yet connected to the world in a weird way. And even then, with that connection, it would take another 52 days, for the drills to bore a hole wide enough to begin to pass a man in a cage through. And you have a great image and another metaphor that you use. It's a chapter called The Astronauts.
Right.
And and it's this moment where the level of isolation and desolation is so great that they bring in NASA people,
right.
Because nobody has experienced this sort of thing before, except possibly astronauts.
Right. And NASA has all this advice, you know, think of it as a marathon because, you know, allow family contact, but only, you know, for a certain number of minutes a week, because if you get more family contact than this amount of time, then you start to think of yourself not in the mine anymore or the spaceship. You start to think of yourself back among your family, and you can't really be with your family because you can't solve the family's problems. You know, many of the men, the first question they asked their wives or girlfriends was, did you pay the bills? Are you paying the bills? And so, you know, so NASA is giving this advice that's appropriate to astronauts, but these are men who did not sign up for the mission, you know? And a lot of it is inappropriate. And so, but of course, health-wise, they took care of their health. But yeah, so it was, you know, and then they have the matching uniforms. So I describe it as they're like astronauts, you know, in this mission to the center of the Earth, you know, that's the way I describe it.
Finally, after 69 days, which is just an impossible period of time to imagine, these guys are one by one lifted out of the mine. And you have another metaphor that you rely on, which is, you know, irresistible. Why don't you run with that?
Yeah, well, this is not something that I made up. My imagination is quite vivid, but not that creative enough. And I just heard this from several, first from several women, you know. Maria Segovia, who became the mayor of the camp, and she was the sister of one of the miners, she told me that, you know, it's like they're coming up this stone cavern, and it's like when a child is going to be born, because she had given birth, you know, she's a grandmother, she'd given birth several times. So, and she knows, anyone who's, you know, who's gone through labor, who's been in the delivery room knows that there are complications. Things can go wrong in a birth. And so the men were being reborn. It also happens that some of the men, when they're coming up through this stone cavity, their lives played back before them, you know? It's like, of course that would happen, you know? It's like, I remembered when I met my wife, and I remember the day I got married. I remember all the things that happened to us in the mine. And so go, because it took like 30 minutes, and so you had time for a lot of, and you're in this enclosed space. So they had time for reflection. And so for many of them, they were literally and psychically reborn, and they were going up through this birth canal. And so that was definitely the whole the metaphor, the system of that metaphor was absolutely irresistible.
These guys, they're out, they're above ground, there's enormous joy, there's tears. They are internationally famous at this point. There is some money, but maybe not as much as they thought. And yet things for a number of them take a turn for the worse. They're trophies in some ways and symbols of things that they don't really want to be. And they're you know, when you say they didn't sign up for, what happens to these guys out in the real world once they're reintegrated?
Well, I think there was first a few weeks of just absolute celebration. They went to Disney World, where they had to wear they were given faux mine helmets with mouse ears attached. And they were grateful because they're going to Disney World with their entire family. Many 22 or so or 24 of them accepted a free trip to the Holy Land. I mean, come on, who wouldn't? You know, they were given hats that said, you know, I love Israel. And so it's advertising. You know, you pay like $100,000 to bring, you know, these men to Israel, but or to Disney World, and you get this free global advertising. Look, here are the Chilean miners. They're, you know, they're here at the birthplace of Jesus. Here they are in Bethlehem, paying homage to their faith. You know, and so there was that. Many of them right away began to say, you know what, this is a little bit too much. The president recalling them back and forth again. His speeches, his speech writers were working the mine rescue using the mine rescue as a metaphor for what the administration was going to accomplish. You know, the tunnel which our engineers dug is not the last great project Chile will undertake. You know, that kind of thing. And what people didn't know was at the same time they're carrying this intense trauma. You know, it's a case of post-traumatic stress unlike any seen before in history, because they were trapped underground longer than anyone in history. They were in darkness. They were in humidity. They were listening to this constant oral torment. One of the men just told me it was that every day, just hearing this over and over again, this rumbling, it just made me crazy, you know? And so they really had a lot of sort of deep psychic trauma to deal with at the same time that they're being, you know, paraded around. And very quickly also they realized that they were probably not going to get rich, mostly because there's 33 of them. And so you give them anything, you'd have to divide it 33 ways. So, yeah.
Let me ask you one last question, and then we'll open it up to the audience for a few minutes of Q&A. In the title of your book, the subtitle, you have the word miracle. And reading this, I could be wrong here, but I don't recall seeing a lot of miracle language in the book. I really don't recall seeing the word at all. As a writer trying to describe these events, were you conscious of how to use that or to not use that, whether that was a shortcut or whether, I don't know, how did you, it seemed like an obvious omission.
Yeah, there was already so many strange things. There are some things that the men saw that to them were either God or the devil acting, in the mine. There's one scene where Omar Regadas, one of the older miners, feels a breeze and he goes deeper down to the mine to find where the breeze is coming from because he believes it's there to make him feel better, and he never finds the source of this breeze. If they're trapped, how can there be air coming into the mine? And so he doesn't understand it, and he believes it's the hand of God. It's the breath of God. And so there was a lot of that. There was even more, you know, for, especially from Jose Enriquez. But I think that in the end, you know, my editor suggested, you know, that word. And I thought the miners definitely thought of it as a miracle. You know, they, for them, what happened to them, what happened the first day, even before they were rescued, the fact that this entire mountain collapsed on top of them and no one was hurt, as one man put it, even a scratch. You know, I think the worst thing that happened was that one of the men who had some false teeth, he was actually a younger guy, he lost, you know, 4 or 5 molars. That was the worst thing that happened to any of them that first day. So to him, that was a miracle, the fact that no one was killed. So I decided we should keep that in the title.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I think we have time for 10 or 15 minutes of questions. Hopefully you've all thought of some good ones as we've been talking. Do we have any Chilenos in the house here tonight? All right. Very good. So hopefully we'll hear from a couple of you. You can fact check Hector here.
First question. My name is Todd. I just wanted to ask, did you do any research with other survivors of similar type incidents, such as Ralston, who was trapped in the desert, having to cut off his own hand, or other people who are maybe trapped on boats or stuck in the same way?
No, the only thing, I mean, I did do tons of research for technical details and mining and the Atacama Desert. I found out that Charles Darwin had been through that same portion of the desert, so Darwin makes a cameo at the beginning of the book. I would say the one time that I did something where I tried to figure out what was happening and doing research was I heard all these stories of dreams. So several men independently told me that they had these really vivid dreams on the 14th or 15th day of starving, you know, of waiting to see if they were going to be rescued. And so many men told me stories of dreams that I searched it, you know. I searched dreams and starvation, and I found that many people who fast, you know, deliberately fast for more than 7 or 8 days comment that one of the things that happens to you is you start to have vivid dreams. So obviously there is some sort of biochemical reaction taking place. So that was something that was none of the men knew about, but I discovered that, and it really did make, you know, it did really bring that passage alive. And I researched it because I didn't want people to think that I was making this stuff up or that I was being overdramatic, you know. And then to find this scientific cause for or link to the dreams, I think that really helped a lot. But that was about the extent of my research into outside forces. Just studying mining and that particular mine, that was already pretty, that was enough to study.
That's a great part of the book. They can't go anywhere physically, but they travel in their dreams. Question up here.
Noches. Noches. My name is Lorena Manriquez, and I'm a Chilena. My question for Hector is, you know, they had made a pact, the miners had made a pact that they wouldn't tell their story unless, you know, tons of money. So how did you get access? And how and at what point did you get to that, you know, to them actually, and how?
Well, the pact that they made was that they would all share in whatever the proceeds were, that especially they thought of the first 17 days as the most precious thing that they had. The story of those days of survival, the way they prayed, the way they suffered with hunger, the stone across the ramp, that was the most special thing they had. So they were already getting offers from the surface. Some people were saying, you know, oh, I got offered, you know, so many $1,000s to give an interview. And, you know, it's like, wait, this belongs to all of us. No one, you know, we all share in this together. And so they made this pact underground. Later, they signed up with a law firm in Chile. That law firm contacted the biggest law firm in Chile. There's a passage in the end, near the end of the book, where they go up in the skyscraper to the Carey and Associates, the biggest law firm in Chile, then in the biggest skyscraper in Chile, and they signed these agreements. And so several books had come out, you know. There was one by a journalist, Jonathan Franklin. They were done with maybe a few interviews, a few quick interviews with the miners. And so it was decided that those lawyers contacted William Morris Endeavor, this agency in New York. And William Morris Endeavor, looking at this, thinking what would be best to tell this story, how it might be, become the biggest story it could be, said, we need to have something more literary. So we need a novelist. We need someone who's a journalist. We need someone who speaks Spanish. we know someone, we need someone maybe who knows South America. And I had been the Buenos Aires bureau chief of the LA Times. So there really aren't that many people in the United States fit that description. And so I was chosen.
This is your sweet spot for sure.
Did any of the 33 sustain lasting physiological effects?
Physiological, well, you know, many of them already had silicosis, you know, this lung disease. And I think that that's the most common lingering thing. I would say that the lingering emotional, psychological thing is still, I know, still present for at least a few of them, because I talked with one miner a few weeks ago who told me that he had quit his job, that he was on medical leave. So I think that is the most lingering thing that they have. Yeah.
Another question. Question over here.
Hi. Hector, can you talk a little bit more about what you mentioned, which is that this has become a point of reference for Chile and the people of Chile, and maybe can you talk a little bit more about how this event affected the national identity of Chile during and after?
I have this moment that I describe the sound of this wrench that the miners were using to hit the pipe that come through to break through them, and the sound travels up to the surface, and then church bells sound throughout Chile because they've been rescued. So it really was this moment of extreme pride for the Chilean people. There was also a lot of pride in the way men conducted themselves. It's especially the very first interview or video that Mario Sepulveda filmed, which it was actually edited. It was much longer. He spoke for 30 minutes. In the unedited video, he cries at the end. He weeps when he starts to talk to his son. They cut that out because it was too depressing. There were lots of other sections of the video that were too sad for people to see. So the edited version that came out, Mario comes off as this lover of life, you know, a character that Anthony Quinn should have played, you know, that he should be alive to play this character. And so there was a lot of pride in Mario. In fact, Mario, the last story that I just read about him was that he was considering running for office finally. And so I think there was a lot of pride. And then later there was a lot of suspicion among people, especially when it became sort of this all-encompassing 24-hour news story, and the government was very clearly using this for the government took a chance in trying to find them. They necessarily did not have to be responsible for the rescue, so that was a risk that they took. And then later they tried to get, you know, they tried to reap the rewards of that. In fact, one thing I did not know, that, and it's one of the few things I quote from another book, is that the Chilean government was actually doing polling during the rescue. So they were polling to see, who's more popular, the president or the minister of mining? Of course, the mining owners, their Q factor is like near zero. And at one point, there was concern in La Moneda, the Chilean presidential palace, because the minister of mining had a higher favorability rating than the president. And so, for example, they wanted to call it, you know, Operation San Lorenzo to bring them out. And it was decided they should not do that, because Lorenzo sounded too much like Lawrence, the minister of mining. So they tried to call it something else, you know. And so in Chile, after they came out, there was a sense of pride in what happened, but also a sort of sense of exhaustion with the story. And, oh, those guys just got rich. And after they got out, maybe a month afterwards, a paper called La Segunda, which is more of a tabloid, actually added up how much had been spent rescuing the miners, how much had been spent on each of their trips, the cost of the Oakley sunglasses that they were given, because they were given these Oakley sunglasses, and you know, many of the men still own those Oakley sunglasses. They were given a motorcycle, a Kawasaki motorcycle. That's cost 20,000, you know, 20 million pesos, you know, and so that also became a stigma. Many of the men were immediately asked, can you lend me some money? You know, they're repossessing my furniture, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think in Chile there is there's an ambivalence. I think there is a lot of pride. It's this moment the whole country lived together. So, and of course, you know, mining continues to be tied up with the national identity. Of course, the government of the president Piñera became extremely unpopular. And he was essentially, the conservatives were voted out of office in the most recent election. So It's a mixed sort of bag, I think, in Chile.
Tell us real quick, was anybody criminally prosecuted or held civilly liable for the conditions in that mine?
An initial investigation by Chilean prosecutors found there was not enough evidence to criminally charge the owners of the mine. And the civil suit is still pending. Yeah.
All right.
Next question.
Yes, I had heard that one of the miners had a wife and girlfriend who both showed up in the mine. How did that play out?
Well, one of the first things I learned was that he wasn't the only one. But the other thing I did, you know, that was absolutely always my comic touch in the book, because I interviewed Yon Barrios, is his name, and he is doesn't look like a catch, let me put it that way. You know? And he's kind of a paunchy guy, and he looked a little bit like Fred Flintstone, you know. And I didn't use that reference in the book, but that's sort of why I always thought of him as Fred Flintstone. He was so gentle, and he earned a good salary. And so, you know, there's a story that the media circulated that his wife became aware of the mistress at the mine because they both met there. That's absolutely not true, because those two women lived less than a block away from each other. And as I quickly learned from Susana was that he had, he had met, of course, Susana when he was married to Marta. He had moved in with Susana. And when he fought with Susana, he would go back to his wife's house. Mm-hmm. And, and so sometimes he would be gone. Susana would not find him. She'd call the wife. Yoni isn't home. Do you know where he is? Yes, he's here with me. Don't worry. You know, so this man, and the reason why he became famous is that he was less disciplined about having a mistress than all the other men were. He allowed both of the women to come to the site and talk to him on the video conference. And so he couldn't decide. That's really the main reason why he became outed as the guy with the two wives. Now, he was already living with Susana. And part of the other thing, too, is that in Chile, divorce did not become legal until a few years before the accident. So it was hard to get divorced. There was ways of doing it, you know, always. For generations, people have been getting divorced, but it takes a lawyer to annul your marriage, and it's very complicated. So many of the men were in that situation. I am told now that he has moved in with Susana again. He's living with her. He's always lived with her since the accident. I really thought he looked very much in love, I have to say. They seemed really, really bonded with one another. And as far as I know, in fact, I heard that they got married. I haven't sort of quite confirmed that. But yes, and so they lived within a block of each other. And when I went to Yoni's house, Susana was telling me about Marta. He says, yeah, she lives right over there. I said, really? He said, Yoni, show her where she lives, you know? And he sort of hid, you know, in the corner. And she says, go ahead, I'm not going to hit you, you know? And then he goes down to the street and he kind of points over there, like, and we went to go talk to Marta, yeah.
Question right here.
Was it a great engineering achievement, the rescue?
I think it was a great achievement. No one had ever done that before. It was modeled on a rescue in Pennsylvania, but that rescue in Pennsylvania only went down a few hundred feet. This went down more than 2,000 feet. So they had to drill this hole sideways. The Chileans, I think, were really astute in that they recognized we need the best of everything in the world. And so when they decided they're going to drill a hole sideways to get these guys out, they said, well, who does the best, drilling of this kind of type of machine? So they called Kansas, a company in Kansas. They said, well, who's our best driller? And they said, well, it's a guy. It's that guy. He's in Afghanistan right now. And so they brought him from Afghanistan to Chile to dig this hole. And so I think that it was a really outstanding technical achievement in terms of the fact that it had never been done before, and it was so deep, and all the men were brought out alive. The Chilean Navy built the capsule. I went to the Navy Yard where they built it, and patented it afterwards. They patented the capsule. And so, yes, I think it was a very, very a stunning achievement, actually. Yes.
Question right here.
Do the 33 still get along? Do they have reunions? Or they have gone off and moved on separately?
They have reunions. Not everybody comes to them, I think, now. They were reunited recently. I think that whenever something happens with a film, they tend to get reunited. I would not say they get along as a group very well at all, although they sort of do get along when they're in the same room together. But if you speak with one group of one man, he'll complain about another. A lot of them, the very first thing they wanted to tell me, the very first thing was, you have to know that Luis Ursúa, who they call the leader, he wasn't the leader. And so a lot of people wanted me to know that. And so a lot of people said, you know, Mario, you know, calling him like, he's crazy. So a lot of people wanted me to know that. And a lot other people wanted me to know, you know what, Mario, he was the person who saved us. I'm not an ingrate. Until the day I die, I'm going to tell you, Mario Sepulveda was the man who rescued us. So there's, you know, lots of personality divisions. Some of them have done better than others. You know, Mario is the most famous of the miners. He still gives talks, although at the same time he's working in a construction company to make ends meet. They recently voted out their board of three miners as directors. They voted Luis Ursúa out of the director and put in other. He doesn't recognize the new board. He says, I show me the paper that they're, you know. And so this has gone on. However, they are 33 guys who are brothers because no one else knows what it was like to go through that. And so they really are bonded together for the rest of their lives because what they lived through, not just the collapse, but also the rescue and then the craziness that happened afterwards, they're the only ones who've lived that. So I think they will probably forever be bonded in that sense.
If you haven't seen it, they did a video together for the World Cup on behalf of the Chilean.
But not all of them were there for that, actually.
There wasn't all of them. Okay.
There were actually some extras in there.
This will be our last question right here.
Sir, excuse my ignorance. Has your book also been published in Spanish?
An extract was published in El Mercurio, the largest paper in Chile. But we've sold the rights in several foreign territories. None of those foreign editions has come out yet. But we're hoping that Spanish will soon be added to the list of foreign rights. The men know now what the book says, in part because there was a very long passage that appeared in more than 13,000 words in the New Yorker. And the famous New Yorker fact-checking department called Chile and talked to, you know, maybe 20 or 30 of the miners and actually checked the facts that were in that piece, which was wonderful. You know, I always sort of imagined that happening. And so many of the men actually broke down with the New Yorker fact-checker, you know. as they went over this, because whenever I go down there and I start talking about what happened, they begin to say, oh, yes, you know, because I have this way of remembering it in which I'm telling the story. And for them, what they're living is still the story. And so there's all this baggage. But when they think about what really happened those first 17 days, then I think it makes them stronger. And I'm really, some of them have read, they know what's in the book because they have daughters or sons who've been educated and read English. Mario Sepulveda gave an interview to the Santiago English language paper. He said, yeah, that Hector Tobar, yeah, that's a good book. I like his book. He doesn't say great things about me. He says that I was happy and sad. But you know what? When you have to be a leader down there, you got to be different with each guy.
That's awesome.
Thank you all very much. Thank you for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.